Welcome to the Humorous Union of Madison, and discussion today on Greg Epstein and the New Humanism, and particularly on his book, Good Without God, which some of you have read. I wanted to remind you that 2 years ago, some of you were here for Sarah Olberg's program, in which she talked about conferences she had been to. And the one that she was by far the most enthusiastic about was the New Humanism Conference at Harvard University in 2007, which was organized by Greg Epstein. And since then, he has completed this book and it was published last year. So I guess we'll turn it over to Barbara to give us a further introduction.
Okay. Greg Epstein is it chaplain at Harvard for the humanist students, which is one of two in the country. We went to hear him speak at General Assembly. So I haven't read his book. I just heard him speak and then read this article on a new online New Humanism online magazine. So I just have a few things to say regarding hearing him. I was very impressed with his positive attitude just towards everything. He said he had not heard of humanism until 10 years ago. He was raised as a liberal, in a liberal Jewish family with a father who was, he talked about constantly seeking groups, trying to seek something where he could be with people who said things that he believed, and his father never did find such a group. So Greg was not exposed to humanism early. So it's interesting that he ended up being the one to write the book. He went to a class at Harvard on liberal branches of various religions as part of the class. And at the end of the class, he said to the instructor, "You need a book for this, you know, there's no book." And she said, "Well, there you go. There's a place to make money. Write the book." So he did. So he essentially defines humanism as people who are good without God, which is the title of his book. He thinks people who are humanists should live ethical lives of personal fulfillment and service to others. And he's really big on the service. He emphasizes the good in the good without God, as opposed to emphasizing the God part. He said he feels that belief in God is irrelevant. That in a time of, say, global warming, does it really matter if you believe in God, who he calls one of the most influential literary figures in the world? But does it really matter what you believe about God? What matters is what you do, how you behave in the world, how you live in the world. So he feels that is kind of the key. No matter what metaphor you prefer about God. So when people say they believe in God, it's like, well, what God do you believe in? Which metaphor do you believe in? So when he works with his students, somebody in the question and answer period was talking about how they have a meetup sort of humanist group in this city. And she said they mostly discuss books. And she was complaining that they weren't getting many young people at this, or any. They were getting all the oldsters. And he said, do action. He said, you know, we associate the old line humanists, like those of us here, with talking. And what he does with his students, rather than doing a lot of discussing, is he does a lot of doing. He talked about one thing that they did, which was he took his humanist student group to New Orleans. This was before the oil spill. He said, who knew, we could have stayed. And they went in parallel with a fundamentalist Christian student group. And they tried to do as many of the actions as they could together and have meals together and talk together to kind of begin to bridge, because many of the humanist students had never talked to somebody who was a fundamentalist Christian. And I wager that most of the fundamentalist Christian students hadn't talked to too many humanism. So that was an example of kind of putting your ideas into action. And that's a lot of what he stressed during the talk. Like I said, I haven't read the book. I was just very impressed with his very positive attitude. He talks about the new atheism that we've talked about here, some of the Dawkins and some of the other writers that have been dubbed the new atheists. And he said, you know, they talk about, in some cases, about sort of being at war with religion. And he said he feels that's superfluous. Why would you waste all your energy doing that when there's so much positive that needs to be done in the world? So, let people have their metaphors of God and go out and do good. So as I said, he, in the good without God, he stresses the good.
Okay, I'll follow up on that. I have at least skimmed the whole book, but I focused on one particular aspect that really struck a chord with me. Following up on Barb's talk about his focusing on the good, he begins this segment with talking about the golden rule, and as I think most of us have, whether it's in UUism or humanism or whatever, have seen various aspects of religion that have something in it that is reflective of the golden rule. And he said that does not require a god, and that a lot of the what he calls kind of the rules and regulations of various religions are set up maybe to enforce that rule or clarify that rule according to that particular religion's ethical system. He looked at the Ten Commandments, and I just found it very fascinating, his take on them. And he was looking at them kind of with what would humanists have in their curriculum for teaching children. Well, if humanists already have something of this nature in the curriculum for teaching children, which is what he based some of his revisions and modifications on, was directly out of some document that has been used in humanist Sunday school. So these are not his words, these are mine. But they reflect, I think, how he got into this, is essential commandments for teaching children how to be a good person. And obviously they're meant for adults as well. And this is reflective of what is in the book. Before I get into it, I'm just going to pass around. I've extracted his modifications for you because I'm going to be talking about two different things. He looks at the commandments and then kind of condenses and abbreviates them, kind of like a revised, Epstein standard revised version of the commandments to make them briefer and simpler. But then he does a humanist take on that. So what I'm handing out is his humanist take, so that as I get into this, you can be clear as to which is which. I need to keep going. Most humanists, I think, would agree with Epstein that laws and commandments must come from reason and compassion, and that humanists do not have simple answers to any and all legal and moral questions, and that we feel no special allegiance to laws created in earlier times to deal with earlier problems, or supposedly by some kind of divine decree, or from an outdated value system. That does not preclude our adapting ancient laws to current situations. And some age-old laws may need no revisions. I found much to ponder in Epstein's segment on the biblical Ten Commandments. The first two commandments he condenses as do not worship any other god, and do not make or worship idols or images of God. And he acknowledges that some scholars interpret these more generally, but he still finds it very peculiar that a creator of a universe would begin his ethical commandments with worship me properly or else. Which, of course, introduces the notion of punishment. That's the or else. Instead, Epstein began his ethical directives, which are adapted from a humanist Sunday school lesson, with seek the best in yourself and others and in your own ability to make a positive difference in the world. And I think this may be the closest he comes to something like a golden rule. So seek the best in yourself and others. And number two, pursue truth and honesty in all you do, and be wary of allowing power, status, or possessions to substitute for moral courage, dignity, and goodness. And I think this is reflective of what Barb has just said. Epstein cautions against focusing on unfairness, on the qualities we lack, or the shortcomings of others. He says, when people die, carry on the good things they did and learn from their inadvocacies without fostering hatred or resentment. Those aren't always easy to do. And I think very worthy of pondering. Epstein's condensed third commandment is, do not misuse the name of God, or as we've probably many of us have heard, do not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. There are a number of interpretations of that, but that commandment in its entirety also implies that God will punish those who don't heed his word. Epstein's substitution is to be positive and constructive rather than negative and disrespectful. He refers to a Harvard study, which some of you may know about, titled Winners Don't Punish. Have any of you heard of this? Winners Don't Punish, in which players in a game lost in the long run if they expended their energies punishing opponents who had betrayed them. So it was a study, and the expenditure of that energy on punishing and getting even caused them to lose the game. Epstein cites real-life examples, such as the Marshall Plan as opposed to the Treaty of Versailles, or on a personal level, child-rearing techniques that award positive behavior as opposed to constant threats of punishment. Epstein's condensation of the fourth commandment is simply, keep the Sabbath day holy. You must rest on that day each week. His humanist revision reads, to be healthy, you must balance work, play, and rest. And which he said, in this high-tech era, is not easy to do. And I think a lot of people at this table realize that. he refers to the secular humanist designed self-management and recovery training program. I don't know, is anybody here familiar with that? It's for people with addictions. Acronym is SMART. And participants in this program recovering from addiction are encouraged to find new activities and to balance work, relaxation, and family time as a part of becoming whole again. And that he emphasizes the need to talk directly with one another, I think individually, within groups, and globally to resolve such imbalances. For Commandment 5, honor your mother and father, Epstein substitutes, all members of the family should respect each other. He challenges humanists to steal family values back by celebrating diverse families and our more welcoming, nurturing approach to life. So celebrate who we are, celebrate the family values within humanism. Epstein takes pride in humanism's tradition of equal respect for couples and families who are gay, intercultural, interracial, and interfaith. He's not speaking for all humanists in this regard, but he's certainly speaking, I think, for a strong majority. He believes the human need for companionship, touch, compassion, and trust is best enjoyed in long-term monogamous partnerships. He's not saying it can't be found elsewhere, but that he feels this is where it's best enjoyed. He says, although feelings for a partner or a spouse may change, therefore, people should wisely choose their partners and not to meet all personal needs, but to nurture each other throughout a lifetime. Epstein does not alter commandments 6 through 9, which I call the do not commandments. Do not commit murder, do not be unfaithful to your husband or wife, do not steal, and do not lie or speak badly about others. Actually, I think I took you through 10. He does state that in general, and I'm reflecting what Barb said, the good is that which facilitates human dignity and the health of the natural world that surrounds us and sustains us. The bad or evil is that which creates needless human suffering. And I'm going to read that again because I think that's the crux of this whole book. The good is that which facilitates human dignity and the health of the natural world that surrounds us and sustains us. The bad or evil is that which creates needless human suffering. And I know some of us would extend that suffering to other creatures as well. Epstein follows this in the book, which I'm not going to discuss, but he has a fascinating discussion on ethics, on the scientific study of morality, and the problem of determining which negative actions are worthy of censure and which are punishable offenses, which is a whole presentation in itself. He condenses the 10th commandment to read, do not be jealous of other people, and do not desire other people's spouses, houses, or anything else they have. Now, this, I think, comes right out of a Sunday school. It sounds like it's aimed for kids. His humanist version is much more positive. When you see nice things owned by others, let them be your inspiration, rather than a source of bad feelings. If there are things that you want, work hard to get them. Epstein's take on coveting is that a fleeting desire is not a sin comparable to concrete action. And certainly... Well, he doesn't think it's punishable in the way that you will hear it perhaps in segments of the Bible or in some other religions, that don't go around beating yourself up if you had a tiny moment of lust, I guess, put it that way. Rather than beating ourselves for a lapse in our own ethics, we should examine our behavior and work on adopting a more realistic attitude about how to attain the things we want and whether they are really worth attaining. And that's his number 10. But he adds three more. I mean, who's this humanist who's going to be content with just what somebody else has said? And these are, I think, very, very current and very in keeping with where a lot of us people here are coming from in their thinking. And that the first is voluntary simplicity, which has been the subject of workshops in the Harvard universe, Harvard humanist community, and obviously elsewhere. We can choose to focus more on energy, or we can choose to focus more energy on the few things we do need and let the rest drop away. This can range from material objects to one's purpose in life. Anyone who knows what my house looks like is going to snicker at that. Another Epstein commandment is sustainability. For humans to survive, it is crucial that we put aside outmoded, petty differences and learn to live in an ecologically sustainable manner, individually and globally. I saved what was actually his 11th commandment to last because I think it really speaks to me. And it speaks to me, I think, because of the age I am, which is not 16. Epstein also advises us to continue to grow. We should not expect to achieve perfection, but as long as we are alive, we can still use our time constructively. As long as we continue to grow in some way, we are living, not dying. And I conclude with a final quote from the book. None of us will ever fully recover or be healed from the human condition. But we can grow tremendously in our abilities to understand and to feel and give love and affection and empathy. We can build up those around us and we can build a better world. That's humanism in a nutshell. Recognizing the difference between magic and reality, then bringing people together to help each other get on with the work of growing and building.
I have a quote I'd like to read from the book briefly. I read the first chapter and most of the last chapter. People need community, not just out of some whiny desire to be hugged or avoid loneliness. We need community because we succeed best in life when we can count on reliable help from a wide range of individuals with a range of skills and talents, all of whom know us personally enough to treat us as their own when we are in need. You just don't usually get that kind of feeling from working in the same office with people, or living in the same apartment building, or even on the same rural street. That's the focus that Greg Epstein mentioned when I met him at the Hugh Humanist breakfast in Minneapolis, and I gave him the Humanist Union's mailing address because he said the Humanist chaplaincy at Harvard would be sending out mailings to groups around the country dealing with this idea of building humanist communities. And the last chapter of the book deals in more detail on this. He's talking about his vision of seeing humanist growth to the point where humanist groups have their own buildings and run their own programs out of those buildings eventually. So that's the thing that I was looking for most and that I've been most impressed with in what he's pushing for. He's a kind of young leadership that has succeeded in building a humanist community in the Harvard area, and he's hoping to see this sort of thing promoted elsewhere around the country. So, comments and questions?
Something you just said, Bob, or a quote of him you just made, had to do with not thinking that the kind of community he's talking about is found at the office or what in neighborhoods or apartment buildings. I don't entirely agree about that. I think it can be, but every year is less likely to as we enclose ourselves with our our television and various electronic devices. Back when people sat on their front porches a good deal more, and when women were at home, and who took care of old Aunt Cassie by having her move in with you and take care of the babies, and you saw to it she was fed and clothed and buried. Back then, I think we did have that kind of community on the block or in the small town, the neighborhood, the family, and I have certainly lived in apartment buildings which were in many ways a community, probably necessarily aligned against the landlord, but I think in today's world, it's an acute challenge, really an acute challenge, because people are much more concerned with what's happening next in light of their own lives and getting there than in what happened and how we got here. And you know what they say about people who ignore the past.
He goes on to talk about exceptions to what he was saying, such as college dorms sometimes can be a real community that people remember for years afterwards. But he is a young man talking about today's world. He's like 31. Go on.
I told Alita that if I were to write a book with this title, it'd be quite different. I'd stress the history of religion on the one hand. If you look at the history of religion, most religions have not had an ethical deity. That is the one who says, thou shalt not, thou shalt what? Most religions have been like ancient Greek religion. Zeus was not an ethical deity.
Unethical deity.
And the same is true for
there are a lot of lessons to learn from Jesus.
It's sort of preposterous to think that you have to have a deity, like Zeus, to be good. People don't need it. The other thing I would have stressed is the social psychology of moral development. And some of you might be more overwrought with Jean Piaget and his followers than me, but there are he has these stages of moral development. And what are they? Moral egocentrism, the smallest children, me. What is it? Moral absolutism. And he illustrates this by looking at children playing games of marbles back there in Geneva, Switzerland. So the children know the rules, and the rules are inflexible. And that's where fundamentalists are stuck. Moral absolutism. And moral, what did you call it? Moral reciprocity is sort of a more advanced game. So the children understand that the rules of marbles are made by people and can be altered by people. They're not absolute. Let me just finish by trying to recall a paper I read some 30 or 40 years ago titled Child Control Through Coalition with God. It's a small sample in Nebraska. And they asked a simple question of the respondents. Do you tell your child that God will punish you if you are bad? And yes or no. And what they found was that people use this argument with their children when they don't have much else to control them with. So they, if you're poor, ill-educated, and you can't really help your children, you can't offer positive reinforcements, then you call upon God to help control your children. And people who have the resources don't have to call upon God for the threat of God. When they somehow ask the question, which parent do you feel closest to? And it was the parent who was most remote, who had less effective control over the child, who was more likely to use this coalition with God. And they also found that they asked the children about it too, and children believed it when their parents told them, but it didn't necessarily make the children more ethical.
One of the things that Greg said at this conference was that he was so excited to walk around and have people come up to him and say, you know, I'm a humanist or I'm an atheist, and know that they were in a religion. I mean, that they were UUs. Because some of the research now is saying that, especially in young people, they say, I'm spiritual, but I'm not religious. And he felt that people benefit so much from community, that that's one of the... So he was thrilled, he said, to be in a community where people weren't afraid to say, I'm a humanist. I'm a humanist, and I'm a religious humanist. I'm part of a religious community. And based on what Delita was saying, with the importance that he gives of being in community. And he was just delighted, he said, to be there and have those experiences.
So is he in favor of the organization called the Religious Humanism? Religious Humanists?
He didn't.
Who accept all kinds of people of various faiths?
He didn't. I didn't hear him comment, did you?
I don't know.
Crazy question. I don't know.
The father of religious humanism is the minister who wrote these 10 sermons. They were giving these books away at First Unitarian Society in Minneapolis. He was at that congregation. John Dietrich is his name, and he was at that congregation until 1938. So religious humanism was strong in that location back then. I don't know. The Hugh Humanists put out a journal called Religious Humanism, but it's been a hit and miss sort of thing for the last several years. So maybe it'll come out 3 times a year the way it's supposed to once, now that we have a new president for that group.
You should try to look at the consult their webpage. I haven't looked at it for a couple of years. That'd be interesting. We could get quite a lot of information.
It's not surprising that that was back in that was in the 30s, because that's when the Humanist Manifesto, the first one, came out.
Right.
Because Reverend Scott was one of the signers at the Universalist Church in Central Illinois. Not Champaign, but one of the Central Illinois churches.
Can you define religious humanism? I guess I was under the impression that by religious humanism we meant that humanism in itself was our religion. But
there's a debate.
Asked the question if you could be, I mean, I don't know how you could be a Methodist. And
I gave a little presentation here about 2 years ago on that, and I forgot most of the details. Well, one thing I really remember is that one of the members was a Catholic priest who was actually paid by the Vatican, and he's a professional astronomer, and he was then, and I don't know if he still is, in charge of the Vatican's astronomy program in Tucson, Arizona. They have their own telescope, they have their own astronomy research center there.
Thank you, Governor.
His address officially is the Vatican, but he lives most of the time in Tucson. At least he did. Yeah, so. But he was a very active member. It was 2 years ago of the Religious Humanist Society of the United States of North America.
Can you answer that question, Mark? Because you're the one that used the phrase religious humanism.
I don't have a definition of it. I know that there's been a debate, is humanism a religion? And then there's sort of secular humanists who want to divorce themselves from any impression that they're connected with religion. And there's the religious humanists like Jane Espenson said that since she's a humanist UU minister, she's a religious humanist. I'd be interested in hearing how she defines it. It's a matter of degree, I think, what sort of thing people emphasize.
It's sort of whether you're a humanist first and a Catholic or whatever next, or whether you're a Catholic first and a humanist next.
Well, I think the term religious humanist refers to people who are not necessarily affiliated with any other religion. They just emphasize their spirituality and things like this, and are not anti-religious in their attitude.
Well, similarly, I've heard the term Christian Unitarians quite often, mm-hmm. and we know how to define religion, we know how to define Unitarian, and as far as I'm concerned, let's stick say religion as religion, but humanism is a philosophy, it's a mindset, and it's a more intellectually based thing, mm-hmm. you know. So never the twain shall meet, or they can get along cohesively, but I think there's not much point in trying to really nitpick and say, come to a nitpicking kind of...
I have a comment on that. The nitpicking came in an interesting way, and someone probably has the history behind it, with the Ethical Culture Group, which are also called themselves Ethical Humanists, in terms of now having been officially declared a religion, I believe I'm correct.
A non-theistic
religion. And, Buddhism is considered a religion. It's not a theistic religion. And so, and I agree that, in my opinion, it's an ethical system or philosophy.
I think this discussion is interesting because we're falling into the same... track is probably the wrong word, but Greg Epstein is so inspirational because he focuses on the actions that we should be doing.
Yes.
And not on the definitions that many, many times drive us all apart. And it's not just in religion. I think it's just a basic characteristic of human beings. You pick some organization that you feel strongly about. I think a lot of guys know me and know that I love my dogs. So I have friends who are dog breeders, and I have friends who are dog rescuers. We all love dogs. But I can't have those two groups over at my house at the same time. The differences in their philosophies about animals drive them apart. Mm-hmm. And I think that people like Greg Epstein are so inspirational because he reminds us that 98% of everything that we do as human beings should bring us together. It's the 2% that probably doesn't matter that much that drives us apart. So I just, I haven't read his book, but I did read Christopher Hitchens' book. What was that latest book he wrote? Someone help me out here.
Hitch 22 is his latest book.
Okay, yeah. Well, before that.
That's his memoir, yeah. Is it The God Illusion?
Well, that's Dawkins.
It's
not
Dawkins.
God is not
the one.
Yes. God is not great. I think
it's
great.
Yes. How religion poisons everything.
Yeah, how religion poisons everything. And, I agree with many of the points in his book, but again, he was focusing on something that doesn't matter. What does it really matter if someone believes in God or not? So I think that actions speak louder than words. I think that's part of the moral code of all human beings, and that's what we should all be focusing on. So.
I'd like to follow that up with a question of Barb and Bob, because I'd like to know if Epstein has given examples of, he talked about going with his students to New Orleans. Has he given examples of what other humanist groups are doing in terms of some kind of action? Certainly the national organization, they were in Haiti just very quickly after the earthquake, as was the UUSC, the Unitarian humanitarian group, they've got a legal fund, which is not exactly the same kind of action I think you're talking about. But I'd like to know if there are examples throughout the country as to what humanists are doing.
I don't think I don't know that he does that in the book, but he certainly includes an appendix of humanist and secular resources of a whole series of groups which are doing things of various kinds in the country, ranging from Camp Quest for kids whose parents are free thinkers and want their children to have a camping experience where they're not, like a church camp, but you don't get indoctrinated and you get to encourage to think for yourselves. And the Foundation Beyond Belief, which has been started by Dale McGowan, and is for the purpose of providing humanists and atheists and agnostics humanitarian outlet. They choose charities to support, and the members of the organization choose for each quarter, select the ones that they want to support, and as humanists, they contribute money to support these organizations.
The question I have is, why is it so important to label your group humanist versus Methodist if it has to go to New Orleans to work? Why don't you say, let's get together and go to New Orleans?
Mm-hmm.
Why is there a
and then drop the label.
This is kind of a devil's advocate, because I think there is a need. I think there is a need. The humanists are going there, the Methodists are going there, and the dialogue, of course, could ensue, but I think ultimately, 98%, we just want to go and be of service to some people in need.
And after
and that's the way I think I would like to organize.
Right.
A bunch of people from Mass want to go to New Orleans. And I think we have some need to label as humanists, some need to label Methodists. And I'm not sure where that fits in all this, but the pluses and minuses to the labeling process. But I think just and keep going.
Well, as Steve would say, we need to go.
Right, exactly.
The important thing is that you go.
I'm not sure I 100% agree with him. I think there might be a need to label the group humanists. Maybe
but
not.
I think he would
I
say,
have
the humanists go with the Methodists.
Right.
You know, I mean, that doesn't mean that, because he feels so, he seems to feel like having humanists together as, you know, kind of as a self-supporting community is an important thing, but then go off and do with others where you find common ground.
I think the example he gives grows out of the fact that he had created a humanist community at Harvard, and as a community they were looking for something to do in New Orleans, so they went as humanists. I don't think they decided to label themselves as humanists as part of that. They were already part of a humanist group.
Well, except that he said they had humanist t-shirts. And he felt that that was important, that they go, because there's so many negative feelings about humanists, atheists. He talked about that minister that had the discussion between Obama and what's his name, who also ran for president?
McCain.
Remember the first time they talked, that was that very sort of right-wing minister in California?
Mm-hmm.
And he was interviewed later, that minister was, and somebody asked him, would you vote for an atheist for president? And he said, absolutely not. And Epstein said, well, that's about, what, a third of the population currently that he just dismisses offhand as people that he would not feel were fit for office. Mm-hmm. So one of the things he says, and I think why he would go as a humanist very openly, is because he feels that there is some very severe prejudice in the body politic, as it were, against atheists, humanists, the kind of the free thinking sort of group, and that it's important when you do stuff in the community to go as a humanist. So, like I said, all of his students had humanist t-shirts on.
I would argue, extend that argument a bit and say we do it to create community for ourselves. We call ourselves humanists because there's a body of ethics or body of things that make us come together.
Share.
So our sustainability, as he says, is generated by calling us humanists. I think the art is to keep it low on, to wear it on your sleeve, to do it very gently. Mm-hmm. That's the problem. We say us versus them. That's not the name of the game. The game is to come together from common separate groups that they're great to our community, come together to adopt another activity together.
As long and that's how he would stress
that's the real art I see. Wearing your identity on your sleeve and not
but still just, coming
I'm the best. I'm the best. I'm gonna beat you at this.
But still coming together.
Yes.
I'd like to use Habitat for Humanity as an example. One of the requirements is that you're there at the beginning of the day when prayers are said. And the problem is that frequently people who do not participate in that prayer service are criticized And the same thing on the groups going to New Orleans or wherever, that when they start with the prayer service and you don't participate, you're immediately seen as an outsider. And overcoming that is one of the difficulties in this dialogue. And if you can talk about your common humanitarian approach, and we're here to help someone, and you can get past your non-participation in the prayer service, then you can have a dialogue. But in my experience, that's a very difficult barrier to overcome.
Let me back up a little, because Christina put her finger on it a while back. And the commandments here also reflect this. What humanism, I think, is about, and what I think this author is saying, is that it's about inclusivity, not exclusiveness. And when we were back talking about definitions, and by the way, anybody who's been in this group a while remembers that at the very beginning, we spent many sessions on definitions and didn't come to any more conclusions than we did much more briefly today. But the point you made, Christina, that I was thinking of was about an absolutism, the kind of commandments that Moses, we understand, handed down from the mountain. They say do and don't and thou shalt not. And the same is true with a great deal, for instance, of the religious right, and Al just pointed it out with Habitat even, that you may not do this or you won't belong. You must do this or you won't belong. And I think the whole idea of this author is that's irrelevant, superfluous. Belonging is the important part, not the name of it, not the rule of it or the concept of it.
There are
belonging,
lots of rules here.
Sure. Yes, there are. But the ultimate goal of those things is to belong and do.
Thou shalt not be unfaithful to your husband or wife.
Mm-hmm. And that has to do with the earlier part about respect for family.
You can't criticize Hitler.
Well, where does it say you can't?
You must not speak badly about others.
Always these exceptions.
That's a bit, yes. That's one of those very literal interpretations. You're playing.
Yeah.
Donnie is playing devil's advocate. I understand, but that's one of those very literal interpretations. And I bet this author would laugh and say, "Yeah, if you want to, you can find rules in everything," but. The point of the whole spiel, the whole ambiance, is let us live together in harmony, let us be good to one another, let us learn from one another, and where one person has a lack, let another supplant it, and not deign to offer it because he or she hasn't fallen under the right definition.
People can find rules in anything,
and
as you say. no one tends to find rules more readily than lawyers. So speaking as a lawyer, I see a certain sort of tangle of separate issues in the discussion, and that I find fascinating. But community. This is rather introspective, this group of people getting together. Identity, this is the t-shirts. You can have a community with, just call it the get-together society, and nobody, I actually have an old cheap trophy that was presented to somebody by the get-together club. I just thought it was cool, so. And I don't have that many trophies in my own. Growth. Growing the community is a separate question from having the community or having an external identity with the community. And then a fourth issue beyond community identity growth is service. And if the object, which is what I'm hearing him say, is to have community and have service, then identity and growth are secondary concerns. But I see these as separate. And then just as a comment on one of the other things that was mentioned, the notion of anti-humanist sentiment. I can't say that I've ever encountered anti-humanist sentiment per se. And when you talk about sentiment against groups that include atheists, agnostics, humanists, blah, 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 yeah. I was once, many, many years ago in Sweden. It was late at night. We were all drinking, some Swedes, some Americans, and one of the Swedes got philosophical and he said, well, what do Americans think about Swedes? And I was forced
that
to...
That implies they think.
you're more brutal than I was. But what I had to say, which I thought was an honest response in reflection, I hate to break it to you. Americans don't think about Sweden. It's not that they don't think. They don't think about Sweden. That was my point. And my guess is that the vast majority of certainly the people in North America really don't have an opinion about humanists. They're not all that familiar with what it is. I mean, there was some diverse opinion on how to define various stripes. And the other is if I were encountered somebody who said, you know, why weren't you praying? Especially in the context of a communal project to build houses for the poor, I hope that I would remember to say, quoting from the book of James, show me your faith without works, and I'll show you my faith through my works. This is something which Catholicism embraces, but Protestantism, for the most part, does not. But, you know, if nothing else, it'll make the other people think and maybe buy you enough time to get hammers and nails and get about the business of the day. But those are just the associations I have with what I was hearing.
Would you repeat what you just said? Yeah. Show me.
There's a quote in the book of James, a book in the Bible that Martin Luther personally wanted to have removed from the Bible.
By your deeds, yes, shall know them. It's a biblical verse.
Right. It's
right.
But there's a specific challenge, and I'm doing my best to paraphrase, you know, the King James Version that I knew years ago. Show me your faith without works, and I will show you my faith through my works or by my works. Yeah. And it's right there, and I kind of. You know, I was probably reading this in college for a course, and I thought that was,
It's by your works shall you know them, but not by their faith shall you know them, isn't it?
No, by your deeds.
Yeah, which is consistent with this thought, but it's a different quote or a different section. One of the things I've noticed in my life, I have any number of friends who are Catholics or fallen away Catholics, and all of their children participate. Whether it's a religious family or a family just, you know, where the grandparents came over from some part of Europe, which would happen to be Catholic, in projects and community projects. Mm-hmm. And I thought, that's remarkable. I do not hold a brief for the Holy Roman Apostolic and Catholic Church, mm-hmm, particularly, but that aspect of actual on the grounds, hands on, doing good works in contemporary North America, I think is a remarkable thing.
You'd find it in the Baptist Sunday school too.
Mm-hmm.
You'd find that the 12-year-olds are all involved in various kinds of quote Christian unquote, but they label it.
They label it Christian, and they probably do a little bit of proselytizing, or
just a bit.
You know.
So just thought of. Just let me ask this question though, because a lot of the organizations that you put out there are Christian organizations. The ones that I know, I mean, like the one you mentioned. Mm-hmm. What's wrong with praying? Why not hold hands with them and pray? What's wrong with that? It's their organization. You're there volunteering. Focus on what matters. Don't focus on what doesn't matter. I feel like atheists get these labels or humanists because we put up a fuss about things that don't matter.
Yeah,
Epstein
said
that makes it important too.
Epstein said when they were doing this with the Christian group that they took turns, and the humanist kids participated with, and then the fundamentalists did their prayer thing, and the humanists participated in it to see what it was like, you know,
or maybe to show respect to people that.
Well, and also that was part of their learning because they didn't know other fundamentals, so they wanted to see what they were doing. And then the reverse was also true. Sometimes the humanists led, and he said it didn't work out quite as much as they wanted. They they ended up at the end, I guess, doing different things. And the humanist kids were disappointed that they couldn't spend more time with the fundamentalist kids. So yeah, that was considered part of the learning experience as opposed to a divide.
Pat?
There were situations where I would agree with you that it doesn't make any difference and you should hold hands and go along. But I think if you're being untrue to a very firm and strong belief of yours that you should stand up for what you believe in that situation. And what Al was, the example Al was giving on the difficulty of dealing with a label in a situation like Habitat, that's a universal problem. I mean, everybody goes through situations where they are the outsider in something. Whether it's because you have blonde hair, because you're overweight, because you're black or green or yellow, or an atheist or whatever, once you do the thing that you are determined should be done and trying to help get something accomplished, if you stick with it long enough, eventually those people who looked askance at you because you didn't pray with them or whatever, will look at you and the deed is what counts. By God, this guy really did a good job here. This woman really took care of this person. Maybe she's not so bad, maybe the humanists aren't so bad after all, or the atheists aren't so bad.
Yeah, humanists, atheists,
and eventually, yeah. That's how you reach a point of tolerance and integration is getting, you have to put yourself in the situations where you're the odd person and take the time to.
Yeah, right. And humanists and atheists and agnostics don't have a whole bunch of buildings that are the agnostic cathedral, atheist memorial hospital, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, bipeds trying to do nice things for others that we basically have.
I want to state my point of view as one of the younger ones here. First of all, with community, I really like the idea of community. Growing up agnostic and a skeptic, by the time I was 18, I was going off across the country to skeptical groups just so that I could get a nice dose at least once or twice a year. But on the other hand, I'm at the point now where I get really irritated when they expect me to stand up and pray with people. It seems to me more like the truth. They don't need to pay for these things, at these things. They're just almost trying to force their opinion on me by having these prayers. I'm speaking, for example, of my union group. The local doesn't do it, but you go up to the state level or the federal level, they insist on having a prayer. I mean, two, they do it non-denominational, so one time it's Jewish, the next time it's Catholic. But, I mean, I've really had it with that sort of attitude that there needs a prayer. I really think, I mean, it's much less being godly or spiritual, and much more, we want to be for good people, so we're going to hit you over the head with this thing. And there's no place for that, and I think it's totally inappropriate, and that's why I give money to groups like Unity for Religion, so they stop that sort of thing.
I think another issue here, and Warren's probably got the data on this, and it's been brought up before, is where secular people stand kind of in the hierarchy of prejudices, and we're pretty much at the bottom. And in terms of acceptance, and someone just talked about, well, would you vote for an atheist for president? And so I think that puts it in a little different situation than if we were a group that was more in the middle of that continuum. And I think that in some cases it's the right to be who we are in a so-called democratic society, and
without being demonized.
And there is deliberate demonization. I followed the history of it through various movements. I gave a presentation here on it at one point in time, and And I think that we've kind of evolved into the, quote, socialists these days that are getting lashed, but humanism has been deliberately used as a means of getting followers for those people who would rather we weren't around. So.
I was really shocked when you said he arranged with the fundamentalist group. I questioned how fundamental that group was, because growing up as a fundamentalist, it never, I mean, secular humanists were like next to the devil.
You heard it in the
pulpit. And I think it's important. I mean, it wasn't until I went away to college and realized, hey, there are nice people out there that aren't fundamentalists. And they do good things and everything. And I think it's important to identify as something other than, I mean, because the fundamentalist life is so insular.
Of course, these were Harvard students.
Well, yeah, okay. Yeah, yeah. But that's why I say I questioned that they were truly fundamentalists. Because they grew up so, I mean, the community is so insular that, and the other is so feared that. You kind of need to be in their face sometimes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But after you're around them a while, you're not so feared. So the college students that you went to school with,
exactly.
They changed you, and you no doubt did some changing of some of them.
Got that.
I think in work experiences, I think our former president, Rachel Long, is an example. She works within a strongly Catholic organization and church that she's a Catholic hospital and clinics that she's involved with as a psychiatrist. But she's been with that group for a long time. And it's very interesting to talk to her about, because they have a lot of meetings that she has to go to, there's definitely a very strong religious orientation to policy and plans and all, and but yet she's been able to function as a UU within that for decades. Our daughter Tara works in the Methodist organization. It's the financial support, and it's a system for foster children and children being adopted. And many of those organizations, those human services organizations, are funded by, over long periods of time, by religious groups. They're the people who come up with the money and the organization to make a lot of these social agencies work. And I think that anytime you work with any social with Habitat for Humanity, or you get involved with anything involving, particularly things involving children and young people, you're often going to find funding-based, philosophical-based people that started these groups are usually a Christian organization. But I think you can successfully work within them, and whatever you want to call it, by your own witness or whatever you want to call it, you can show them that you can do the equal work and you can do good works. And
but there are also groups that don't. When I was working with the Catholics against the death penalty, you know, we had them men for the death penalty. They never pushed it on me. They never pushed their religion on me, not even once.
Yeah.
They just sat down there and said, we're against the death penalty, and anybody wants to help out, help out.
Epstein was saying in his talk that, you know, that the faith-based initiative from the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
This for the first time, there were humanists invited to participate in at the White House with the faith-based initiative, and he was one of the representatives of the humanist community to the faith-based initiative get together. So that was he felt that was a very positive step, and that, you know, he also talked about the fact that Obama included non-believers in his list in the inauguration speech. But so at least federally now, he's kind of putting his money where his mouth was when he invited the humanists into the faith-based group.
Yeah, it would be more impressive if the federal government were defending the religion's right to discriminate.
Yes, well, that there is that.
Right. You have his voice in there now.
Yeah. So that's an advancement.
Any other concluding remarks?
Put the comment that their political power was also a powerful factor. We realized that the fundamental was Christians and were working very effectively for 10 years, 25, 30 years now to load our government with their graduates. With law degrees and similar degrees from the graduate schools, which are akin to Muslim madrasas, basically.
Yeah.
And they've been very, very successful. There's still a lot of these people now making decisions at the top level of ours in our government. And gradually, 100 people in Obama, I think those will be moving out. It's a lot of momentum. That's a very, very serious matter. These are all fundamentalist religious Christians who decided they were going to dominate the United States and through the United States as much of the world as they could possibly do.
Did the French do more to guard the names that you can put on a wine label than America does to guard what the word university means? Liberty University is not a university, it's a theological seminary masquerading as a university, thank you very much. And that includes their legal part.
During the Bush administration, some of them were a law degree from Liberty University was equal to somebody with a law degree from Harvard.
Oh, more than equal, because he was more likely to be praying in the chambers of our Attorney General each morning. Thank you, Mr. Ashcroft. That's, I don't think that's really correct, but that's what they're from.
I just have a very brief remark. I think the dilemma with a group such as this is very similar to a dilemma within the Unitarian Society where we're meeting, and that is time and energy and the ages in which a lot of us are in terms of doing work as an entire group. Doesn't mean we can't. That doesn't mean we can't have a meeting here that is focused on doing. But I think there are a lot of people sitting right around at this table who do and who have lifetimes of doing for others in many, many, many ways. And I know you. I mean, I know what people have done in this group, in terms of community service, in terms of giving their professions to the community, to the betterment of other people and the betterment of the world, and to the good. And so that's another aspect of it, is how much energy when Epstein talks about focusing your energies into what is best for you, then that's another decision people have to make, is how much we can do as individuals and how much we can do as a group. And I think that there is great importance in doing something as a group, but it's to the extent to which we can, I think that we have to think about that very hard. Well,
thank you to our panelists.
Thank you.